Welcome to Deception in the Last Days with your host, Randy Shelton. Randy is a member of the Biblical Discernment and Research Center. He has been studying cults and new religious movements for over 30 years. Join Randy as he discerns the deception going on now in the last days.
And we have been looking and are still looking at current events concerning wars and rumors of wars and possible stage setting for future future Gog-Magog war that's spoken of in the prophet Ezekiel in chapters 38 and 39. You know, there's so many hot spots in the world today, but the ones that, of course, I've been really keying on are those around the Holy Land, in the ancient lands over there, and in the Mediterranean Sea, all of that area near Israel, and also as far up, of course, far north as Russia. But because they have a reach now down in that area, even more so now that they have the warm water ports that they have. So we want to continue. We were looking at an article last week I left off, and the name of the article is The Armenian-Azerbaijan Conflict and Its Implications for Iran. It's from the Bessa Center. Two gentlemen whose last name is Khoshnood, Arvin and Dr. Ardavan. Khoshnood, and this was from October 16th, 2020. So we will continue at the bottom of the page where I left off, speaking of the Iranian regime, as it's termed, the regime here. The regime must make a choice. The Islamic regime is in a complicated position in which two principal interests contradict one another. Supporting Armenia could strengthen the position of the Islamic regime in the region, but to do so would imply that Iran is turning its back on Azerbaijan, a Shiite country. And of course, Iran being one of the big players in the future Gog-Magog war that's coming, we draw our attention to these local conflicts in the areas of these countries, because as I say, they would appear to be some of the wars and rumors of wars, obviously, that Jesus spoke of when he spoke of future prophecy events in the end times. Further in the article, it says, doing nothing is not an option. The regime does not want to allow Ankara, and that's the capital of Turkey, to increase its influence in the region to Iran's north. Turkey's deployment of jihadists to the region constitutes a serious threat to Iran and the Islamic regime. This could explain why Tehran wants to involve Turkey and Russia in resolving the conflict. The regime will attempt to use the conflict to pull both Ankara and Moscow, of course, capital of Russia, closer to Tehran, the capital of Iran. And Iran and Turkey, these are, of course, the capital cities that they're using respectively to represent their countries. Iran and Turkey have established an increasingly close relationship, and the regime will strive to make it even stronger. Turkey has been a good economic partner for Iran, and both are hostile to Saudi Arabia and Israel. What will the Islamic regime decide to do? A principal doctrine in the foreign policy of the Tehran regime is its perception of itself as the mother of all Muslim cities. This doctrine is likely to prompt a pro-Armenian approach. The Umm al-Qura doctrine, which is the mother of all Muslim cities, helped the regime convert its foreign policy from idealism to realism. In short, the doctrine claims that if the regime falls, there will be no one left to defend Islam and the Shiites, which of course is one branch of Islam. The regime must therefore prioritize its own security and strength, no matter what the cost. The Islamic regime's survival is more important than the lives of some Muslims. And of course, they're referring to the Azerbaijani Muslims that are involved in this conflict with Armenia. Accordingly, it should be expected that the regime will support Armenia, at least to the limited extent that states in the region can influence the conflict. This support will probably be provided covertly in the form of providing Armenia with civil and war material, as well as intelligence and diplomatic support. The Islamic regime will strive to avoid direct confrontation with Turkey and Azerbaijan. However, Tehran's support might become more overt depending on how the conflict develops. Will Turkey continue to deploy jihadists to the region? How will the U.S., the EU, and Israel react? How involved will Russia get? All these factors will have an impact on the Islamic regime's decisions. Now, this is an article that I've had for some time. It really is back from September the 9th, 2020. And this is just a great time, I think, to share the contents of this article. And the title of this article is "The Emerging Warmth of Turkey-Iran Relationship Shows the Myth of the Sunni versus Shia." And this is, I refer to this in last week's podcast, the myth of Sunni versus Shia. There's always been, of course, a battle between the Sunnis and the Shias. But in this case, in these end times, we see these two big players in the Ezekiel prophecy to come, coming together and showing the myth, so to speak, of Sunni versus Shia. They're getting along well. They're working together well, as we see more and more. Now, let me get on with the article by Seth Frantzman, and this is from the Jerusalem Post. Pro-government media in Turkey widely embraced the recent talks between Ankara and Tehran. They are at least the sixth round of such talks that have generally been held in the framework of discussing Syria. Iran and Turkey ostensibly back different sides in Syria, but in recent years they have grown closer due to joint opposition to the U.S. and also Israel. Iran and Turkey both back Hamas, for instance. They share a regional worldview on many issues. They are increasingly cooperating now against Kurdish dissident groups. The Iran-Turkey emerging warm relationship turns counter to the ideas that have been forward by commentators, think tanks, experts, and strategists that have divided the Middle East into sectarian camps of Sunni and Shiite, some of the branches of Islam, the major branches, actually, those two. This paradigm arose only in the last decades, whereas before the region was portrayed as divided into other camps, such as nationalist regimes or pro-Soviet regimes, and those closer to the U.S. We are told that Turkey and Iran cannot get along because one is the descendant of the Ottoman Empire and the other the Persian Empire. One is Sunni and led by a pro-Muslim Brotherhood party, and the other is Shiite, Revolutionary Islamic Republic. The rhetoric coming out of Tehran and Ankara doesn't sound like Persia versus Ottomans and Shia versus Sunni. Turkey today embraces Iran and pushes for dialogue with Iran to find possible solutions to problems in their shared region. Turkey's president indicated, according to the Anadolu news agency in Turkey, dialogue between Turkey and Iran has played a determinant role in resolving many regional problems, Turkish President Erdogan said at the sixth meeting of the Turkey-Iran High-Level Cooperation Council. Iran's Rouhani agreed, "I believe our cooperation will return to its previous levels as the epidemic subsides." Let's compare this to the daily dose of Iranian regime views of other states like the U.S., Israel, or Saudi Arabia, or Turkish media daily attacks on France, the U.S., Israel, and other countries. Iran's supreme leader said this week that Zionists and arrogant powers' anti-Islamic policies are behind such hostile moves to divert West Asian nations and states' attention away from evil plots U.S. and Zionist regime are hatching for the region. The Zionists, of course, referring to the Jewish, to the Israeli people, folks. Turkey's foreign minister has said Europe's racist spoiled children should know their place. Ankara has compared several European countries to Nazi regimes and threatens Greece daily. That's like calling the pot, the kettle black, however that expression goes, comparing a future battle with Greece to the defeat of Greeks in wars 100 years ago. One would have to go back many years to find similar insults by Turkey directed at Iranian regime leaders. That doesn't mean Iran and Turkey see eye to eye on Syria. It means that they have agreed to partition parts of Syria and Iraq into spheres of influence. Iran sees Iraq as its near abroad, and Turkey sees northern Syria and northern Iraq as its near abroad. Both regimes are intensely hostile to Israel and Saudi Arabia, and Ankara has grown hostile to the U.S., embracing Russia. How about that? Iran and Turkey are both growing closer to China. Together, Turkey, Iran, Qatar, and Malaysia have also worked on discussions about a new Islamic currency and other solutions to global Islamic issues. Turkey speaks frequently about the Islamic Ummah, or community, as does Iran, and both countries seek to liberate Al-Aqsa, a reference to Jerusalem's Islamic holy site. The Hamas connection, whereby both are supporters of Hamas, represents the way that Turkey, Iran, and to an extent Qatar as well, are now a regional alliance that is emerging. In some places, these allies come up against each other potentially, such as in Iraq or Syria or Lebanon. Whether the current Turkey-Iran honeymoon will last, or whether it is a temporary alliance of convenience that will inevitably fall apart as they grow stronger, remains to be seen. Now, you know, my comments would be, the honeymoon won't be over until the buzzards feast. And, of course, I'm referring to Ezekiel and the outcome of when God judges this invading coalition, which includes Russia, Turkey, Iran, and others. And so with that in mind, I'd like to turn to Ezekiel 38 and 39, and I'd like to quote some selected verses that we have time for. You know, the judgment on Gog, which is the term for Russia and the other countries with them, I'm going to quote from verses 18 as I have time. Let's see, 18 through 23, I think. Yes, and so let me begin. And it will come to pass at the same time when Gog comes against the land of Israel, says the Lord God, that my fury will show in my face. For in my jealousy and in the fire of my wrath I have spoken. Surely in that day there shall be a great earthquake in the land of Israel, so that the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the beasts of the field, all creeping things that creep on the earth, and all men who are on the face of the earth shall shake at my presence. The mountains shall be thrown down, the steep places shall fall, and every wall shall fall to the ground. I will call for a sword against Gog throughout all my mountains, says the Lord God. Every man's sword, and this is key here, every man's sword will be against his brother. And I will bring him to judgment and pestilence and bloodshed, and I will rain down on him, on his troops, and on the many peoples who are with him, flooding rain, great hailstones, fire and brimstone. Thus I will magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations. Then they shall know that I am the Lord. But the key thing there I'm looking at is every man's sword will be against his brother. There's going to be sort of a friendly or unfriendly fire going on here. A lot of collateral damage to some really evil warriors who are going to be suddenly pitting themselves against one another instead of against Israel. That's basically what this is describing. The Turkey, Iran, Russia relationship is really kind of a tentative relationship, I would say, and a fickle alliance, because, you know, people have looked at this and it's like, wow, this doesn't make sense. Why would they suddenly turn their weapons on each other in the midst of this judgment from God? Well, I think that it doesn't hurt that the fact that there are these, you know, there have been historically these extreme differences between the Sunnis and the Shias, each believing that they are the really true Muslims. So there's probably going to be some underlying hostilities that when all of this confusion takes place, that will contribute to why they're going to start turning on each other. Every man's sword will be against his brother. You know, that's just fascinating, and I've looked at that over the years, and I thought, isn't that something that's coming down the road? Okay, now, also, and moving to Ezekiel 39, and this kind of corresponds to what I said about the honeymoon won't be over until the buzzards feast. It says that in verse 30, in chapter 39, verse 1, and you, son of man, and that's Ezekiel, of course, prophesy against Gog, and that's Russia, and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And of course, he's singling out Russia here, but he's talking about also all of the other alliance members who I have gone over in past podcasts, and I will refer to probably in next week once again for those, or you can read it for yourself, of course, in Ezekiel 38 as the list of the invaders. He goes on to say, And I will, okay, and I will turn you around and lead you on, bringing you up from the far north and bring you against the mountains of Israel. Then I will knock the bow out of your left hand and cause the arrows to fall out of your right hand. And that's, of course, talking about the language of weapons of war here, not necessarily literal bows and arrows. You shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and all your troops and the peoples who are with you. I will give you to birds of prey of every sort, you know, not just buzzards, birds of prey of every sort, and to the birds of the field to be devoured. You shall fall on the open field, for I have spoken, says the Lord God. God is a God of love, of mercy, but he's also a God of justice. And these things will take place at some point in the future. We don't know exactly when. Now, this is an interesting note from the little book that I've referred to before, 101 prophecies, 101, yeah, the prophecies. Anyway, I don't have the full title here, but I've got the quote, and it says, birds of prey would eat the dead flesh of the enemy armies that fall in battle against Israel. It is a little-known fact that Israel is the bird migration capital of the world. Isn't that fascinating? During the spring and fall migrations, billions of birds fly over Israel. Many of these migratory birds are raptors, carrion, dead flesh, eating birds of prey. In fact, 34 species of raptors migrate over Israel. You know, there may not be any buzzards. I just kind of threw that in there for effect. But And I realize it's not a real cheery topic that I'm laughing about here, but we do know that God is a God of love, but he's a God of justice, and he gives people opportunity to turn to him before his just judgment comes. Now, I want to back up to the comments of the last article, together Turkey, Iran, Qatar, and Malaysia. I mentioned that, and then, of course, this other alliance. It mentions, again, these allies. It says that that Turkey, Iran, and to an extent Qatar as well are now a regional alliance that is emerging. And for that reason, I want to mention this little country called Qatar, which it's a little country in the Gulf State country. And you'd think, well, who's Qatar? You know, well, they're right there with all of these near many of these other oil-rich Gulf states that are making peace with Israel, or that are in line to do so. But Qatar is a holdout, and let's just read a little bit more about Qatar. I think you'll find this interesting. This is from the Bessa Singer again. Qatar is pro-Iran and anti-Gulf Arabs, by Dr. Edie Cohen. This is from September 14th, 2020. Normalized relations between Gulf states and Israel function as a deterrent to Iran. Qatar, which favors Iran at its Gulf neighbors' expense, opposes this trend. Qatar and its Al Jazeera mouthpiece must not be allowed to drive a wedge between Israel and its current and prospective peace partners in the Gulf. You see, Qatar owns Al Jazeera, the propaganda wing, you know, that you hear so much about in Islamic countries. The Arab world is far less divided today than it has been in recent years and is moving in a positive direction toward conciliation and unity. Just one Arab country, Qatar, stands out like a sore thumb against this renewed Arab consensus through its support for the Muslim Brotherhood, cozy relationship with Iran, and funding of terrorist organizations. Doha is the only Arab capital to oppose normalization and peace between Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain, and it will likely reject any further peaceful developments between Jerusalem and other Gulf states. Because of its support for the Brotherhood and Iran, which manifests in constant attempts at subversion and pot stirring intended to undermine Arab regimes, the Gulf states imposed heavy sanctions on Qatar to isolate it diplomatically and economically. This siege had the effect of pushing Doha even more deeply into the warm embrace of Tehran and eventually Ankara. Qatar, which has rendered itself an outcast in the eyes of fed-up Arab regimes, is the main loser from the Israeli, UAE, and Bahrain agreements. All the other Gulf states fell in line in support of the treaty, either explicitly or tacitly. Qatar alone, in its vehement objection to Israeli peace with the Gulf states, the Gulf Arabs, has unleashed incessant vitriol against the normalization agreements, mainly through its state-owned broadcaster, Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera stopped pretending to be objective long ago. Sounds like a lot of our U.S. liberal news outlets. There are innumerable examples of this, but its lack of coverage of the protests in Iran and fulsome praise of Qassem Soleimani, a mass murderer and terrorizer of Arabs, clearly demonstrate that Qatar has rejected its Arab identity in the sphere of Iranian influence. Moving on in the article, Al Jazeera has also viciously incited against Israel and encouraged violent Palestinian struggle. Continuing to move, Israel's warming of relations with the Gulf region is a major achievement for both Jerusalem and the Gulf states involved. This rapprochement, which is reflected politically, culturally, and economically, shows that they desire peace and want to support the Trump administration's policies towards Iran and Palestinians. Gulf relations with Israel are determined to the Iranians and are thus looked at with disfavor by Doha and Qatar. Next article really quick here. Take notice, tiny Qatar is powerful. This is from World Watch Today, no date, no author. We sometimes forget that the prophecy in Genesis 16:12, speaking of Ishmael's hand against others, applies most often to the Arab world's hatred of Israel. Remember, it also applies to Arab hostility aimed at other Arab tribes. We see this in the mounting tensions between Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Why the tension? The Saudis are anti-Muslim Brotherhood, while the tiny but wealthy nation of Qatar is pro-Muslim Brotherhood. Also, Qatar has a friendlier relationship with Iran. Saudi Arabia views Iran as the great enemy of the Saudi royal family. Qatar occupies a strategically important position in the Persian Gulf, a tiny peninsula jutting out from Saudi Arabia's eastern coast. It is the world's leader when it comes to exporting LNG, or liquefied natural gas. Their strategic outlook is based on two driving motivations. It does not want to accept Saudi hegemony of the Sunni Arab world. And Qatar wants to be seen as a political force in the Middle East, no longer overshadowed by its bigger brother, Saudi Arabia. A major disagreement exists between Qatar and Saudi leadership over Qatar's financial support of the Muslim Brotherhood elements in the Middle East, including its support of Hamas in Gaza. Okay, let's see if I can skip down a little more here. Another bone of contention revolves around the increasingly popular Al Jazeera television network, which often produces news stories that are slanted against Saudi Arabia. All right. They use the Al Jazeera television, offers Qatar a very powerful bully pulpit. Just think how the liberal media, how they can slant things and wield such power for a minority of people. It's amazing. Well, I draw that similarity here. Now, Qatar, there's actually a population of only 2.18 million Sunnis. Al Jazeera, as we've mentioned, is there. It's the richest per capita country in the world. Qatar has the world's third largest natural gas reserves. You know, brother, can you lend me some moolah for a cup of tea, I would say. That's my own little line. Isn't that what they call them over there, moolahs? I don't know. Anyway, supporter of Hamas. Okay, friction between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. I've already mentioned that. Local media reports that 40%. Okay, I'm going to skip that. Qatar has been steadily buying up much of the United Kingdom. It owns a vast amount of the Canary Wharf Financial District. So you get the view, you get the idea that this little country also has a lot of power, and they're hooked up with Iran and Turkey, as I mentioned before. So I find that interesting. Now, this is also interesting, and I wanted to get this in before the election, because by next week we will know whether these articles are relevant or not. So I want to read them this week rather than next week, since we don't know. This article is also from the Bessa Center. Well, this is from the Bessa Center. It's by Dr. Raphael Ben-Levi, and it's October 19th, 2020. Okay, Biden's proposed Middle East policy would end any prospect for Saudi-Israeli normalization. It is Washington's strong support for Saudi Arabia's security needs, clear stance against Iran's pursuit of regional hegemony, support for Saudi actions in Yemen, and willingness to set aside its criticisms of Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, domestic policies that have allowed for even the possibility of a formal shift in the kingdom's stance on Israel. But Joe Biden has made clear that if elected, he intends to reverse all those policies. The Abram The Abraham Accords were the product of a slowly developing structural shift in Middle East geopolitics that led to an alignment of interests between the Gulf states and Israel. The most central of these interests was opposing the threat posed by Iran and its proxies throughout the region. The current U.S. administration played a positive role as a catalyst that moved the actors toward formal recognition. The Trump administration played this role with exceptional skill in 2020, but Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden intended policies for the Middle East would completely undermine any existing potential for progress toward normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia. Biden and his advisors have stated unambiguously that they intend to reverse all the above aspects of current U.S. Middle East policy. In other words, all the policies that allowed the Abraham Accords to come to fruition. His team policy proposals that would be undermine any prospect of normalization don't end there. This structural shift that pushed Israel and the Gulf states together wasn't enough for its own for the UAE to take the final step of formal recognition. In fact, as long ago as 2002, Saudi Arabia and later the Arab League expressed a willingness to recognize Israel. It was only the recent change in U.S. policy that altered the dynamic. So we won't take the time, as we don't have much time, but because there's one short article more that I want to read, and I'm just about out of time. Okay, but Biden and his advisors intend to reverse that as well, and as he and his team have made abundantly clear for months, Biden adamantly rejects any prospect of extending Israel's sovereignty to additional territory. All right. In November, Americans will decide whom to elect as their next president, and Israel will work and cooperate with whoever the American people place in the White House. One would hope that whoever's making decisions in Washington will be open to learning the lessons of the Abraham Accords. Last article from Israel Unwired by Mika Geffen, 10-2020. Israel Bahrain peace moves forward as the Gulf prepares for a possible post-Trump USA. Most observers view the present peace accords between Israel, the UAE, and Bahrain as a product of President Trump's outside-the-box diplomacy. While it may be true that Trump pushed these parties together, peace came about out of fear of what is coming. President Trump may be closing the gap with former Joe Biden, VP Joe Biden, in battleground states, but his chances of re-election are slipping away, of course, when this article is written. Even if he would win, it may be pyrrhic, given the predicted instability that awaits the USA. With that in mind, the Gulf states understand that only a pact with Israel now can help the region against an emboldened Iran. The UAE and Bahrain have the most to lose if a Biden administration decides to resurrect Obama-era policies vis-a-vis Iran. This is why peace with Israel is a necessity in order to ensure the maximal amount of support against the mullahs. Yes, they are called mullahs. Anyway, peace now brings these two vulnerable Gulf states into a long-term alliance with Israel, and even Cyprus and Greece, who are facing off against an expanding Turkey. Both Turkey and Iran are working together in hopes of establishing their hegemony over the region. Well, how about that? Next week, we're going to look at another newest member of the Abrahamic Accords. And so I hope you'll join us next week as we continue to look at the possible stage setting for Ezekiel 38 and 39. Good night. God bless.